Okay, let's continue with agenda paper 3, which is boundary of reinsurance contract health. And the paper is introduced by Laura.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Okay, so we're now looking at agenda paper 3. We're going to be continuing on our discussion looking at the contract boundary requirements that are set out in paragraph 32. But this time we're moving on to look at how to apply those requirements to reinsurance contract health. So for a cedent. This question has been raised because although IFRS 17 requires that paragraph 34 is applied to reinsurance contracts held, some of the wording in that paragraph is specific to insurance contracts issued. And so when you look at it word for word, it doesn't necessarily work for reinsurance contracts held. So as an example, in that paragraph, it talks about the entity's obligation to provide services. So in the analysis to this paper, the wording in paragraph 34 has been adapted in a way that is appropriate for reinsurance contracts held, and that's from the perspective of the entity as the holder of the contract. The adapted wording in this analysis considers that a substantive right to receive services from the reinsurer ends when the reinsurer either has a substantive right to terminate the coverage, or they have the practical ability to reassess the risks that are transferred to them and can set a price or level of benefits to fully reflect the reassessed risk. It's also noted in paragraph 14 of this paper, which is towards the back, that one implication of applying the words in this way is that the boundary of the reinsurance contract can include cash flows from underlying contracts that are expected to be issued in the future. So that was just a brief overview of agenda paper 3, and now I'd like to ask the TRG for your views on the analysis in that paper.
Okay, thanks Laura, and we start with Kevin.
Thank you, Martin. So I think there's really two things in this paper. So the one I think is fairly uncontentious, which is when you're looking at a reinsurance contract from the perspective of the cedent, you need to take into account the reinsurer's right to reprice in determining the contract boundary. But then I think the second point is the one which is captured in the last paragraph, paragraph 14, which says that one of the implications is that you may include cash flows in determining the reinsurance asset from contracts that you've not yet written. And I think that the results of that are a little bit troubling to the industry, because you end up getting a mismatch between the contracts that you've written and your consideration of the reinsurance asset. And I wondered whether the fact that in the standard, in paragraph 63, you talk about the measurement of the insurance contract asset needing to be consistent with the measurement of the cash flows of underlying liability, as well as paragraph 62, where you talk about where you have a proportionate cover, you only recognize the contract when you write the underlying contracts. Those two principles are kind of going in a different direction. And, you know, could we conclude from that actually you should be getting to a situation where you don't actually recognize the cash flows for the underlying contracts have been written as well? And I think, I mean, the bit about the recognition date being, it says paragraph 62, you should recognize a group of insurance contracts held if the reinsurance contract held provide proportionate coverage at the beginning of the coverage period of the group or the initial recognition of underlying contract, whichever is the later, makes sense. But I guess very often these proportionate reinsurance contracts cover business for a whole year. And so you're only really moving the recognition date slightly later because, you know, let's say the contract signed on the 20th of December, but it incepts on the 1st of January. It seems to imply that on the 1st of January, you take all business you're going to write for the entire year into account in looking at the reinsurance, but not, obviously, it's not direct reflected in your direct insurance.
Okay, Anne?
I actually agree with a lot of what you said there. We discussed this in Australia, and the first point we said, fine, you know, you can reprice from the contract boundaries from the point of view of the reinsurer's ability to reprice, but 14 seemed to be a separate issue warranting discussion in its own right. When we look at a non-proportional cover, we agree that would be the outcome because you're actually on you're exposed to that future risk that will happen in that coverage period. But when you're looking at proportionate covers, you can have significantly longer proportional covers as reinsurance held, and you're writing that over underlying short covers. And so you're going to get this disconnect in your financial statements, this asymmetry with the short boundaries potentially for the issued contract and the long boundary on your reinsurance held. Taking that to through to the financial statements, you'll have whole notes in the financial statements for which there is only reinsurance and there's no underlying cover. It also seemed inconsistent. I agree with paragraph 63. When you read that, it implies that you would actually look to have consistency between the contracts issued and the reinsurance held. And I think the other thing with proportionate cover is you're not on risk until those underlying contracts are written. So there's no risk to the reinsurer at all until those contracts are written. So I think that hasn't really being taken into account, so we're not comfortable with the assertion here in 14b that you would take all that future contracts into account for a proportional cover.
Sue?
I appreciate the fact that people might like the outcomes to be matched, but in terms of reading the words in the standard, I think we need to be careful with pushing this consistency wording in paragraph 63 too far, because surely it's linked in the first instance to the words "to the extent that the underlying contracts are also measured applying those paragraphs," and the future contracts aren't yet being measured. So I think there's a general consistency, you know, to the extent that it's relevant, but I don't think that this is meant to override all of the other more specific requirements in the standard. Even though I appreciate people might like that outcome, I think we need to try and stick to reading the words in the first instance.
Thanks, Secho.
Thank you, Martin. I say I agree with what Kevin and mentioned earlier. I think the suggested interpretation on the contract boundary for reinsurance contracts mirror that for the direct contracts. That is sensible. Yeah, we agree with paragraph 13 in the paper. I believe symmetry between the reinsurance and the direct contract is important. However, the practical one practical issue is that the reinsurance contracts often has a clause for both the cedent and the reinsurance company to stop including future new business under the reinsurance contract, you know, with a notice of maybe 3 months. Yeah. You know, however, the cover for existing business that has already been ceded will continue. So it's not clear how this is included in the assessment here. As to paragraph 14, we note the projection over the future years is required as set out here. In particular, that paragraph, that projection of new business not yet written, needed for direct contract that are covered by proportionate reinsurance. We believe this is operationally extremely burdensome and potentially lead to significant accounting mismatches, especially for long-term reinsurance contract. Yeah. And most reinsurance system, I believe, yeah, are not even equipped to do any such projection. So this additional requirement is operationally very challenging. And we suggest the staff to reconsider this. Yeah. In addition, we should note that IFRS 17 require a consistent assumption for, I mean, talking about consistency, yeah. Consistent assumption for both direct and the reinsurance contracts. This paragraph 14 will lead to complete inconsistency in measurement. So will not achieve that objective of the accounting. Yeah.
I understand that you maybe don't like that, but would you read the words also in that?
We read that and think it's doesn't achieve the objective here.
But the objective is not that we have matching contracts. That is not the objective. The objective is that we account for the contracts
based on all the cash flows.
Based on all the cash flows expected. And not that we have matching principles. That is not the objective in the standard. But okay, Leslie.
Thank you. To be contrary, when we first read this in Canada, we have something similar to the boundary of the contract. Today, in our standards, we call it the term of the contract. And we always looked at this from the entity's perspective, from reinsurance, and whether we have the right to terminate the contract or recapture the contract. And we see the reinsurer's right to reprice as an option they have in the contract. But anyway, understanding that that gets turned on its head, we also have concerns about the requirement to include cash flows associated with contracts that we have not yet written. It feels strange to us that you would set up an asset for something where you don't, on your balance sheet, for something for which you don't have the underlying liability. But that set aside, we identified perhaps a fundamental issue with paragraph 13 and 14 as suggesting a different contract boundary within the contract for those future sessions, as opposed to the guidance in agenda paper, the statement in agenda paper one, where we all agreed there was only one contract boundary for the whole contract. This seems to contradict that by suggesting that there's a shorter contract boundary within the contract for those future sessions, future direct underlying contracts. So unfortunately, we don't like the concept that there would be only one boundary, because that would require you to include the cash flows for all the future sessions that you expect to be underwritten, which we have a fundamental issue with. So we were quite divided on this. We don't like either answer.
So why are you asking the question?
A couple of things. I also read paragraph 63 the same way as Sue does, that the words "to the extent" I think are really important in that paragraph. So, and they say "to the extent that the underlying are measured." In this circumstance, they're not measured, but that doesn't change that you must use a consistent process. I think the other point is I think a clear one that's made, which is the issue that IFRS 17 is about expected future cash flows, and in the context of a reinsurance contract, there are expected future flows that fall within whatever that boundary is that you've established. Those expected future cash flows in this type of contract would include underwriting direct contracts you haven't yet written. That seems to be consistent with the whole view of the standard all the way through. But it also seems consistent with the economics, because some people have mentioned that you shouldn't be creating an asset if you don't yet have the underwriting contract. Well, the reality is you have an asset. You have already underwritten, you've already locked down the underwriting of business that you are still going to write. As long as you expect to write that business, by locking it in, you have a future asset, a future benefit you're going to get. So I think that's consistent with the standard. With the whole objective of the standards, what we're trying to achieve. Have you got a benefit? Yes, you do in that circumstance. So to your point, I think it is important, though, and I think this is we're falling into perhaps a discussion that we've had earlier, too. You made the point that some contracts have clauses in which both parties can at any point choose to stop it and not add new business. And I think that's very relevant. It's not in this fact set. But the moment you had a clause like that, I think some of the tests that are applied in this fact set would immediately fail. And so your contract boundary would be shortened by a clause like that. So again, I think we just need to be careful of what we're talking about in terms of examples. If I have a clause that allows me to escape the contract or allows the counterparty to escape the contract, clearly that is part of the consideration for contract boundaries, I would have thought.
Mazuka?
I mean, I'd agree with what Daryl just said about, you know, the contract boundary, but I think probably just taking a step back, I have no issue agreeing with the conclusion in paragraph 14 of the paper, as long as we are making that in the context of an excessive loss treaty. Because I think but I would probably conclude differently if I'm looking at a quota share. And the reason for that is because if you look at the basic principles when you've got an asset and a liability, and look at the wordings of a quota share and an excessive loss, they're somewhat different. Because in a quota share contract or proportional contract in general, the usual wording in the industry, and again, the other territories may jump in if it's different elsewhere, basically says that the liability of the reinsurer starts, let me just see, I've got an example, commences obligatorily and simultaneously with that of the underwriter. So unless the underwriter has written a contract, the reinsurer doesn't have a an obligation, whereas such a clause does not normally feature in excessive loss contracts. In excessive loss contracts, the fact that you've signed the contract and paid a minimum and deposit premium automatically binds you for a fixed duration.
Absolutely, but I think maybe, and we obviously wouldn't want to get into specific details, but and there may be a lot more to the wording than you just read out, but it seems to me that that wording would imply that the reinsurer is obliged to accept the business once it has been written. They have no ability to turn away that business. Now, that in the hands of the reinsurer constitutes a liability. They have no ability to stop it once it comes. And equally in the hands of the insurer would appear to constitute an asset. They have the absolute ability to pass that business on. The reinsurer has no ability to decline it. And again, I think, and perhaps the one additional point I wanted to add earlier, I think there's an operational consideration which is different. But in the context of the wording, it seems to me there's an obligation on the reinsurer's part, there's an obligation on the direct insurer, there's an asset on the direct insurer's part, a benefit that they have.
Agreed. I think probably the other thing to consider, because again we are looking at the contracts and basic principles, is that excessive loss contracts are usually for a fixed term. They set start date, end date. On quota shares, very often you either have an open-ended contract or you've got a contract with a termination clause, usually a quarter. And I think based on what we were just discussing, one of the unintended consequences could be that you've got a quota share where either party has the right to terminate with a 90-day notice at the end of a quarter. So if we look at that and say, okay, that's the boundary of my contract, it solves the problem for kind of matching between the direct and the underlying, but creates another problem. If you are ceding, if some of the ceded contracts are paying, you know, on installment premiums, you end up with having different installments into different contracts on the reinsurance side. What do you do?
And it may be the point that comes back to something I think that Martin referred to earlier. In essence, the way IFRS 17 thinks about a reinsurance contract is as a standalone contract with its own expected cash flows that you have coming in and out.
Agreed.
It 63 helps you in the way you think about measuring it, but it is an independent, it is its own contract.
No, I absolutely agree with that, and that's how I read it. I think what we need to bear in mind is that we probably need to read the standard a little bit broader, because there is paragraph 2 in the standard that also requires you to consider the customary practice. And although these reinsurance contracts on the quota share have that option of, you know, terminating, it very, very rarely happens in practice, and the reason for that is because if you've got an installment premium in quarter one ceded under one contract, and then you've got and you treat that as a one contract, and then, you know, because for whatever reason you believe that, you know, your contract boundary is a quarter, and the next quarter you've got yet another insurance contract, then I think there is a problem for a measurement perspective, even if you consider the reinsurance contract on its own, because how do you work out what is the probability of a claim and how do you associate the claim with an installment?
Wouldn't you just incorporate that like you would lapse behaviour, and you would just base the probability of the cancellation and just measure it that way? Why is that different from any other contract being measured that has a lapse possibility?
Because on the underlying side, you've got an installment premium, and that installment premium, you know, how do you associate? Let's say I've got different installments that will end up being, you know, treated under, ceded as under different reinsurance contracts. Yeah, if you say that the boundary is a quarter, because...
Well, I'm not sure I would say the boundary is a quarter. I'd say you have to reflect the probability of lapse because of the cancellation in the measurement of the contract. So I'm not saying that the boundary is a quarter. I think this may be going into a fact pattern that we need to separate separately.
But I think, you know, my main concern, if I have to kind of summarise, is that there is a reason why in paragraph 62 we've got that specific mention of a proportionate contract, that you recognise it at the later of the start of a reinsurance contract or the underwriting of an underlying contract.
That's a specific recognition point. That's not something that carries into the measurement. So that's not something that's generalizable into the measurement.
Okay, I mean, I take that point, but I think otherwise, why do you need to do it if you are to treat exactly the same way excessive loss and proportionate? Why wouldn't you recognise? Because you are working off expected cash flows.
The reason for that exception was really a practical concession, so it's a limited scope exception. It's not something that is generalisable in any way.
And also a bit of background with it. If you remember, the board listened to the industry about the operational concerns for the initial recognition of a direct insurance contract, moved it from at risk to the beginning of the coverage period or to the date of the first premium. So to be consistent with that decision, they looked at reinsurance and they therefore also moved the date backwards for these type of contracts. So I think it
was matching, right?
It wasn't matching.
Okay, I think that goes too far. I think not everybody, at least I cannot really follow this detailed, and maybe we go to Jo and maybe you take that offline, and if it is, we can discuss it again. Jo?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the interpretation in the paper. I just think it causes a lot of problems in practice, and that mismatch between, I mean, we think of it as a mismatch, you know. Here you take your point that, you know, you have a right and you have an asset, but it isn't how we think about reinsurance, I think that's the key point. I agreed with the interpretation, but it doesn't feel like the right answer.
Yeah, because you will be showing on the balance sheet net cost or net gain from reinsurance without having the underwriting underlying contract at all.
Yeah, but we have, man, it is not specific to insurance, man. If you look at other industry, look at a bank which has a specific risk and hedge it with a derivative. Would you say, look, you should not recognize the derivative before you have the risk on the underlying? It is odd. And I think, why is that different in insurance, not to account for contracts which are written? Man, that is, you have taken that, and why you should not recognize it and measure it separately. And we have not this kind of concept in other industry. If you have taken a risk and then you mitigate it by other kind of instruments, that you should only start recognizing that when you have the underlying risk. That is not, I think, in any other industry practice. But I think that is a wider discussion, and we go to Gail.
Yeah. So, thank you. So, I agree with the main issue of the paper, which is you look at it from the insurer's perspective in paragraph 34. I would also agree we had come to the conclusion that many of these reinsurance contracts do have a 90-day boundary because of the way they are drafted. And we're just working through what that means, because I think that does the subsequent measurement of the bits outside add some extra complexities, which we're working through. So that's for a separate question. I understand the industry's concerns on paragraph 14. I think, Sue, you asked the question, is that the only way it can be read? Some of my colleagues have read paragraph 14 in the staff paper and do not believe that that means that all your proportional quota share would, you would have to recognise all the underlying in setting up the reinsurance asset. And the way that some people have read the words is that they say effectively the reinsurer has committed to take on those risks, but they will, if it's proportional, you'll just take a proportion of the premium that's being paid by the underlying insurer. So the logic would be that the reinsurer isn't locked into the price, because it's locked into whatever the underlying insurer writes. So it's locked into the commission, but the premium will vary on the underlying contract. I personally struggle with that view, but that is a view out there that some people are not reading paragraph 14 as necessarily answering the question that all proportional quota share would mean you'd have to do all that future estimates. So I think it's important everyone understands that.
The reinsurer can't govern the price that the
it can't govern it, but
there's
no
choice about the price.
But the underlying risk is, it will vary with the risk. That is an alternative approach that's been raised.
Laurent?
No, simply to say that I agree with the conclusion of the paper that the words of the 33 and 34 should be adopted from the perspective of the cedent. And I concur with the concern that have been voiced, that I don't think it would work for a proportional cover, because of the mismatches it would create. It might work for non-proportional covers. So This is a concern.
Okay.
I still come back to the question I asked before about now this seems to have created two different boundaries within the same contract, because the reinsurance treaty has in-force business as well, for which clearly the boundary has not ended. So by setting up this idea that there's a 90-day boundary or whatever for new sessions, you're talking about a different boundary, a different contract boundary within the same contract, which in the concept of a direct contract, I thought there was agreement that there wasn't, that there was only one boundary per contract.
I'm probably struggling a little bit with the facts that you're talking about. So I assume what you're suggesting here is that I would have, let's say, a first quarter tranche under a reinsurance contract and then a second quarter tranche. And
it
your
is
concern
one
would
treaty.
Be,
it is one contract.
Your concern would be that the implication here is that each of those tranches would have different boundaries.
I'm concerned. The underlying treaty has a boundary. I have issued contracts and reinsured them within my treaty. Yep. So the contract boundary, if that was all I was ever going to do, is long. It's until the risk
Absolutely.
Is exhausted, right? But I have now potential cash flows associated with the same contract, the same treaty, which deals with future new business, with future sessions.
Yep.
And you're saying for whether to consider those cash flows or not in my existing treaty depends on the boundary of the contract. But no, it's the boundary of those additional future sessions. You're saying for that purpose, because the pricing of the future new sessions, or everybody has the right to terminate, or the pricing is a new, like the reinsurer has the right to reprice, you're considering that I don't include those cash flows in this contract because they are beyond the boundary of the contract. But no, the boundary of the contract is long for the in-force that I have. So I'm struggling with this. I like the idea, but to me what it means is you're introducing the idea that a contract, that future cash flows which are repriceable are outside the boundary of the existing contract.
I think I understand. So essentially what we would be saying is that you would capture within the boundary of a contract, in the circumstance you've given, all of those where you've already committed it, there's already a price decision, you've taken it on that. If at some future point, let's say the end of the quarter, the treaty allows the reinsurer to completely reprice, so the reinsurer at that point says, I can reprice, accept or decline the business, then at that point what I create is essentially a new agreement from that point forward, and I would then essentially run two parts of the contract. If the treaty says the reinsurer is bound to accept business in perpetuity or for the next 18 months or for the next 5 years, then anything that's written within that five-year period, the boundary extends to the end of that business that's written.
I understand, but I'm struggling with the conclusion in the first agenda paper that we talked about, when I have the right to reprice completely a rider which might be renewed. Like I have it seems to me analogous that I should say if I have the complete right to reprice the rider when the policyholder renews it, that the cash flows associated with the renewal should be also be outside the boundary of the contract. I'm struggling with why it's not analogous. I'm happy to here.
And I think probably what we would have said, and I'm thinking off the top of my head, so now that's your chance to throw something at me. But I suspect what we would be saying is that essentially the treaty, if you have the ability, if the reinsurer has the ability to reprice at any point in the future, such that they can essentially price you out, if you like, so they can essentially, to all intents and purposes, decline the business that would seem to indicate that business that's written after that cutoff point is a new set of business. It's written under new terms and conditions.
Understood.
It has new, and I think that would be the way we'd think about it. I think the difference of the riders is slightly more, is because they are an integral type, they're integral to the contract, which is a conclusion we've taken. If I think about the example you've given, the business I write today, or the reinsurance it's taken on today, and the reinsurance it's taken on at some point in the future, are not integral to each other. They're completely different pots of business. And I think that's how I would get there.
Sure, you want?
No.
I think Daryl has covered it. I think the rider has, there's two things going on, the host and the rider. Over here, you're just having the reinsurance contract, and the boundary is cut to decide the reinsurance contract. It's not like there's two things going on. There's just one thing, and you're just trying to decide what the boundary of that one thing is.
I think it works consistently with where we got to with paper one.
Yeah.
So we look at a contract, and a reinsurance contract is a contract that stands on its own. We don't look through the underlying contract. We do look at consistent assumptions, but we don't open that up. So it makes sense that sometimes you'll get to different conclusions based on that.
Kevin? I just noticed there's some slight inconsistency, I guess, in the fact that you did give some practical expedience. So, you know, Daryl, you made the point that you should recognize the right to the contract because you've signed something of value, but then we have a practical expedience saying, well, don't worry to recognize that until you start writing underlying contracts. And then Joanna made the point, well, you know, we put that in to be consistent with when you write the direct, it's not signed, it's written. But then actually in paragraph 62, we split it between proportional, which is wait till you start writing, and then the other, excessive loss, which is not in line. And I know, you know, it looks like reading the standard gives you that conclusion, but, you know, would you also have the power to ask the OSB to maybe look into this from a practical expedient point of view? I think it's not only that it's difficult to do, it's also that people believe that it isn't necessarily giving users useful information. So the systems are not set up to do it. The new business is not yet written. And also, it's not that useful to see this asset when you haven't actually got the underlying contracts on your balance sheet.
And of course, you know, you can ask. And we're interested in the operational consequences. But I think what we are very keen to try and do in this group, even though I know that people might not like it, is in the first instance to focus on what do the words say in IFRS 17 now, and then as a secondary thing to say, you know, if you wished it said something different, that's still interesting to us. But I think in the first instance it's helpful to have a discussion on what do you think the words say now.
No, I agree to that. I think to have clarity what the words are saying now is a different thing from if you have clarity, say, okay, I don't like it, and maybe ask the board to change it, that is a different issue. And because first we have to make clarity, okay, is the words saying what the words say, and if that is then not liked, it's a different issue. And
on that issue of not liking or liking it, I mean, that's what we're here for. We've looked now at this clears an issue that was open to different interpretations. You set out in this paper the way we think it should be, you think it should be operationalised, and this is what we're here to say, is that it actually is very difficult and in some ways can give a misleading outcome when you do operationalise it. But one thing I wanted to ask was, has there been a change in the staff's view? Because in Australia we discussed this, and one of our members highlighted that in an old staff paper which was issued in 2011, that, in fact, reinsurance contracts do not transfer risk if the underlying insurance contract is not written, and recognising such contracts before the underlying insurance contract is recognised would be misleading and unlikely to provide any useful information for users. So has there been a deliberate shift in thinking?
I don't think the board agreed with that at the time. I think what the board agreed with is what we eventually exposed in 2013 and then standard now.
Yeah. And it talks about, I think, initial recognition, which what you say is really reflected in the standard. It's about initial recognition. What we talk about now is what is included in the measurement, in the boundaries. So what you say, I think, is reflected in the standard.
One word, but the focus of this group is not that you should say what you don't like. I think the focus is what the words of the standards are saying. And clearly, secondly, is okay that we need your expert knowledge to say, okay, if we get issues what people still don't like, we get you, do you agree to that or not, or what maybe need additional information, why is not operational. But I think the main purpose of this group is to say what the IFRS 70 words are saying. And then secondly, we can discuss, okay, does it have any implication, more cost operationally, whatever. But the main focus is first, I think, that we should clarify what the words are saying. That is at least my understanding what the main focus of the THG is. And not coming here and say, okay, we don't like it. That is the second maybe thing. When we have concluded on the interpretation of the words, then we can discuss it, but that should not be the main focus.
So I think this paper does clarify, but the words, people may not like it, but certainly there has been a lack of clarification.
Yeah. Thorsten?
Thanks, Martin. In general, as an observer, I agree with the view of the staff, but I think we have some points, for example, the boundary, the understanding and how to deal with the cash flows and the risks, and from the perspective of a supervisor, I must say, a real insurance contract, at the end of the day, it's an insurance contract, and at this point, I think some clarification could be useful, and that's my point.
Okay, thanks, Thorsten. Roman?
Yeah, I think, respecting Martin, your two-step approach, I agree, I think, on the words of the standard needs to be read in the way as included here in the paper and I think echoed by other TRG members. On the second topic, to give a sounding from operational perspective, yes, it's a concern, I think, to many primary insurers, also in Germany. And I think many of us have not focused on ceded reinsurance or reinsurance health, as you call it, very much. I think this is a step two in the implementation project. So I think we are now seeing topics like that getting more prominently discussed and getting more on the agenda of implementation projects, and then you see the complexity arising, I think, from some of the conclusions support has taken in the past. And there might be one point in time where you need to reassess and the benefits and the costs, which have been, I think, nobody has been able to assess when the standard has been developed. I think that is a fair point. And for me, reinsurance held back. Now, to the content discussion, there's a little bit of difference. If I have in a bank a risk mitigating instrument like a derivative to mitigate certain risks, because that I think I buy it to mitigate a risk of some underlying instruments I might purchase in the future. Here, and with a reinsurance contract held, especially with a proportional reinsurance contract, I really there's a direct relationship of the reinsurance contract to the underlying risk. It doesn't exist, so to say, if I do not write the underwriting risk, this whole contract is absolutely, so to say, worthless, or there's no single euro transported then. So there is, I think, more connection between the underlying business and the reinsurance health in the insurance business than in other industries, where I don't usually have, I think, this connection of some primary business and then pass it through another party in such a direct manner, especially on the proportion and reinsurance business side.
Okay, thanks. Francesco?
Just to address then specifically what do I read in the standard, I now understand that the paper wanted to cover two things. The first one is how to establish the boundary of our insurance contract held. Now that I've heard the explanation from the staff in the debate, I would like to say that I agree with the analysis of the staff. And then the second point, which only became clear to me when Darrell explained his reading of the paper, is effectively paragraph 62 on the initial recognition. And Andrea called it a simplification. That is something actually that we have been discussing in Deloitte. And the way I see that is that the initial recognition is deferred to the point in time in which the first contractor is issued by the cedent. But the question that perhaps the paper doesn't really address is what is the actual cash flow that you need to calculate at that point, given the boundary that has been established? Is that a boundary, and I think the debate is fleshing this out now, is a boundary that includes also future cash flows before their coverage begins or not? And when I read what you've written, particularly paragraph 305 in the basis for conclusions, so there is a reference to the coverage beginning as the beginning of the benefits from the cedent perspective. So the way I read this, the way I implemented it, is to say I write one contract on one day, and that is what I'm going to use to recognize the insurance contracts held. Future contracts will become changes in the cash flows of that insurance contracts held as and when they will be issued. because at that point the coverage begins, and I can then be compliant with paragraph 3 or 5 of the basic conclusion to say the benefit from the ceded perspective only begins when the coverage begins on the ceded business. So this is how I would interpret paragraph 62 of the standard, to say that it is effectively an initial recognition point, but at that point I don't need to estimate future business, not future groups not yet issued. I will wait until, based on 305, the coverage of those groups in the future will begin. And then I will make a change in cash flows on my insurance contracts held.
I think Daryl is eager to respond to that.
So I was busy trying to look at 305 very quickly, but I think the important thing with this is I agree, you're right, in the way 62 applies, is it sets the start date of the contract. But then I think what it would do is it would say once the contract is started, all of the cash flows that relate to that contract. And in this case, and it comes back to the comment that to the point Sai said about how important the clauses are in the contracts, but if the contract commits the entity to a bunch of future cash flows in the future, and those future cash flows relate to other groups of contracts, I think they're still sucked into that individual contract.
I'm
looking at the contract as a single one. I think what you're doing is potentially breaking the contract up.
I'm not breaking it. I'm just making those cash flows come in line with the fact that I have a different recognition basis, and therefore I will change the cash flows when the coverage of those groups, new groups that don't exist at the time of initial recognition, will be coming to existence. And what you've written in paragraph BC 305B seems to support my interpretation. And that's, given Martin asked me what is my view of the words written by the SB, that's what it is.
I find it difficult because if I were to apply that principle to, let's say, a conventional contract, a conventional life contract that gives the policyholder the right after 5 years.
But that's not conventional. This is a special treatment. As Andrea pointed out, this is a special
only
treatment.
For recognition. This for is a recognition point decision, and you're talking about measurement.
Yeah, and I mean, what I'm thinking about is if I give somebody the right after 5 years with a life contract to buy from me a medical rider at that point at a price predetermined, it's a pure option. I think that optionality that I'm actually giving away value, I would consider that value in the determination of the contract value. And this seems to be no different to that.
Other than the fact that you're reading B305B,
okay, so
B saying that's their insurance benefit for the cedent begins
mention,
with the coverage beginning.
It doesn't mention, it says when a group of reinsurance contract held covers aggregate losses arising from a group of insurance contracts over a specified amount, the group of reinsurance contracts held is recognised when the coverage period of the group of reinsurance contract begins.
Right.
In these contracts, the benefits and coverage, whatever it is, from the beginning of the group of the reinsurance contracts held because such losses accumulate throughout the coverage period. That is all about recognition. It's got nothing to do with
measure. And it never refers to underlying insurance contracts, which is what I think you're talking about. This is talking about the group of reinsurance contracts.
Yes, which is why I read this to say the way I recognize on day one is based on contracts which are issued on day one. The first contract is
when
been issued.
When recognize.
And
when
then
day one is one, not how
I recognize
it.
Subsequent changes in the cash flows based on new groups' coverages being written later.
Okay, maybe we have clarified that we think it is only for recognition.
Francesco
thinks, okay, it is further, but I think that's the situation. And JP.
Thanks, Martin. Well, my company, Samsung Life, is not having many portion of the reinsurance business, so we didn't talk much about reinsurance contract. Now, instead of focusing on the technical issues, I will generally focus on the implementation questions on paragraph 7. The submission case asks how to read paragraph 34 of IFRS 17. In this regard, I agree with the staff's view that the wording needs to be adapted in reading to better reflect the business of the insurance contract. In IFRS 17, paragraph from 60 to 70 provides the way to account for the insurance contract held to reflect the special characteristics of the insurance contract. But some insurers in Korea suggested that it would be clearer if 17 may add paragraphs that relate to the way of determining the contract boundary for the insurance contract held. However, from my understanding, TRG is not recommending the standard. TRG is for increasing practical application in implementing 17. In this respect, I think a careful consideration is needed when adding more. Regarding this issue, Korean General Insurers and Korean Accounting Institute asked me to deliver their request that ISB and TIG provide some educational material or some documents that better explain how to account for reinsurance contracts held as a whole on November 17. Reinsurance contracts have, as you already know, different kinds of practices, unlike underwriting contracts compared to underwriting contracts. In that sense, I think TIC needs a lot of effort to find out how to interpret the principle based on IFRS 17 to the reinsurance contract.
Can I just ask one final, if then my interpretation is not your interpretation, is it correct for me to understand that the way you've written the standard is really to give an advantage for a few weeks? Because that's really what matters. When you enter into a proportional treaty, it's only a matter of weeks before the first contract is issued. What is the simplification advantage of introducing such
I think
benefit
and this
when you have to do exactly the same as if there was no simplification at all?
The difficulty was the situation in which you have written, you have signed a contract today, but have not yet got around to capturing it on your system because coverage is only beginning in a couple of weeks' time. So this literally was intended as that gap between the point at which I sign the contract and the point at which the contract actually kicks into gear, it becomes a real contract. It is literally a expedient.
Literally, if that is the case, then I have to say that the benefit you want to provide then is absolutely negligible. You could have saved yourself from doing that.
We actually got feedback on a previous version, I think probably the 2010 version, saying that it created a difficulty because if I wrote a contract on the last day of the year, I often took a week or two to capture it. So it wouldn't be in my systems. And so that was literally what it's meant to do.
And I think, again, man, whatever we have done, if it was a mistake or not, I think we have to clarify what the words say. And then the next step is, if you guys don't like it, then we have maybe a different process. But the THG cannot decide, okay, to change the standard. That is maybe the board and not we. And we have, I think, learned today, okay, that we maybe you all read the standard in that way. But there is an issue which is operational, which is maybe an economic mismatch than what you're thinking, and that is a different issue. But I think whatever we have done, maybe we have not done everything right, may be the case. But I think standard is what the standard is, even if it was, I think, done not in the best attitude or whatever. But it's a different issue. Say, John.
Thank you, Martin. Just want to change the subject a bit. Want to make some one observation here. On applying paragraph 34 to reinsurance contract in determining contract boundary. In the previous session, we discussed policyholder risk. There's one comment that that should exclude lapse risk because such risk is not transferable. Now, in reinsurance space, there are many reinsurance contracts which transfer not only mortality and morbidity risk, but also lapse risk, and often lapse risk could be a very significant component of such contract. And I look around the IFRS 17, paragraph 34 is the right paragraph here for determining contract boundary. So when applying paragraph 34, without considering the wider policyholder risk, such as lapse, would be inconsistent with the fundamental economic substance of many such reinsurance contracts.
But isn't that different? Because my understanding is we said, okay, it should be has to be transferred risk. And if you are reinsured, you transfer that risk which you have.
Yeah.
But if you are a direct insurer with a policy, there is not any lapse risk transferred from the policyholder to the entity.
Not at the individual level, but at the portfolio level, collectively, the policyholder behavior would result in such a risk transfer. Yeah. But we can follow up on that with them.
Okay, man, we have now discussed it for 50 minutes, which was only seen 30 minutes, but Massimo.
Yeah, I agree. I think that somehow the paper reflects at least the objective, probably, of the standard. But, I agree with Francesco. I found a little bit inconsistent that this conclusion looking at the aim of the paragraph 62. So I struggle in understanding how I will recognize, or I will start the recognition of my reinsurance contract looking through the starting of underlying contracts, but I'm obliged in a certain sense to add future cash flows belonging to future groups that are not, linked to the underlying contracts that represent from the cedent the recognition point. So I found more consistent if the starting the initial recognition refers to a scope of contracts that is consistent also with the projection of the cash flows. And honestly, I read this paragraph in the sense that probably the intention was to include a practical expedient to avoid potential mismatch in the accounting. This is for the first area of analysis, so try to understand what will be the prevailing interpretation for quota share, and I'm referring only to quota share. For the second step, as you said, if we are going to interpret in the other way, so we are introducing different boundaries for primary and reinsurance in the context of the proportional, it's not only an operational issue, but also a question mark about the faithful representation of my financial position, because potentially I would increase the asset base in my balance sheet, and especially in a situation where we are dealing with an individual financial statement where we can have tax implication, dividend implication. This is not, something that the user may value as a benefit from this standard.
It triggers capital requirements, isn't it, if you've got the assets on your balance sheet?
The capital requirements are also based on a separate regulation. For sure, potentially would increase the difference between the IFRS balance sheet and the Solvency II balance sheet and any regulatory balance sheet. But my point is, how can I justify
Massimo, again, I think that is understood, that you think it is kind of difficulty if interpretation is what it is, but you think, okay, then we have consequences which is maybe not a mismatch and operationally difficult, understood. And I think there is a different process if you want to address that. But I think you agreed, okay, the interpretation is what we think is the interpretation, because it is saying about recognition and nothing else. And also with the contract boundary, I think it is, usually it is expected cash flows. That is all expected cash flows. And doesn't matter if, but okay, last thing then, I think we will conclude on that.
I think I just want to mention also, it's not that you get a bigger asset by having these additional cash flows. All you get is you're trying to cut the line between the fulfillment cash flows and the CSM. And that's what it affects, because the asset and the liability is trued up to actual cash that's received or paid. So it's not that you get a bigger asset. What you end up is the cut between the CSM and fulfillment cash flows is different if you don't include or not include these cash flows.
I think people would think that looks misleading.
I'm just addressing this one point. Yeah.
That's understood. Azuka? Yeah.
Just very last thing, because I still feel slightly uncomfortable that between the two contracts, quota share and excessive loss, the rights and obligations are somewhat different and different triggered at a different point. Because under the quota share, you've got the benefit only after you have ceded. Otherwise, it does not exist. Whereas on the excessive loss contract, the moment you pay the minimum and deposit premium, you buy capacity. And that's why part of that premium is never returnable. So that's the subtle difference between the two contracts.
Okay. Difficult to summarize, but I think generally what I have heard, okay, that the people agree maybe with the staff conclusion, but they feel unhappy about the results of that conclusion.